then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your bike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's October the 2nd, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, let's kick it off this week with some Northwest Front housekeeping stuff. But before we do, a quick update on who's guarding our guardians. It looks like that deranged Puerto Rican who jumped the White House fence on September the 12th ran in through the unlocked front door and knocked down a female Secret Service agent who was stationed there. Basically because women, no matter how well trained, simply are no match for a determined man who is larger and heavier and stronger and more aggressive than they are. This being a matter of biology and genetics, which is not susceptible to politically correct wishful thinking. This is why women cops are involved in so many officer-related shootings, which is one of the worst-kept secrets in American law enforcement. This Gonzalez character ran in through the front door, and apparently he was in fact waving a butcher knife in the air. He made it upstairs, almost into the residence itself, and made it all the way to the green room and the east room before the FPS goons finally tackled him. Just think, Puerto Rican or not, an ordinary, everyday human being from the real world, the asphalt and concrete and minimum wage world of 30 hours per week outside, for only a few moments, actually forced his way in. Into the place where the crowned monkoids of the Democratic Party, Barry and Michelle, hold their big formal balls for the nation's liberal elite. Where Democrat senators do multi-billion dollar deals with corporate CEOs over cocktails and cigars off in the corners. And where liberal ladies like Nancy Pelosi and Barbara Boxer and Hillary and Chelsea Clinton and Michelle herself with her planet-sized ass encased in gold lame stroll around wearing formal gowns that cost more than a minimum wage worker flipping burgers or humping furniture makes in a whole year. Of course, the dictator's servants caught Gonzalez and dragged him to the ground and beat him for his presumption. And he's going to spend the rest of his days in prison or in a mental asylum for his daring to force his way into Barry and Michelle's world, even for a few moments. I hope Gonzalez was able to snatch a few seconds and take a few good long gulps at the fine wallpaper and the mirrors and the glitter and the scrollwork ceilings before the rain of blows and taser bolts beat him to the ground to remind him of the poor man's place in the world. The poor man of any race. Those few magic seconds that he got in his act of desperation are going to have to sustain him for a long time. Right, first up, friends, Romans, countrymen, if you want to contact me, please email me directly at nwnet@earthlink.net. That's nwnet at earthlink.net. Do not try to leave secret squirrel messages on the comments sections of the Homeland or Thought Crime blogs. I don't do secret squirrel on here anymore since I suspect I may have been successfully trolled by the Chicago guy's internet stalker. And by the way, I'm now pretty sure I know who that stalker is. Genuinely interested parties should not try to contact me through the form entries on the northwestfront.org website because that will slow things down. I only check on that part of the website every few days, and sometimes I admit I let it slip for longer than that. And B, I cannot reply to you directly from the website. Now, the website contact forms themselves are not really intended to get feedback of the kind that people usually send me, which is mostly comments on Radio Free Northwest. For that, we have the comments sections on the Thought Crime and Homeland blogs. Now, the website forms are basically intended for you to leave your mailing address for introductory packets of party literature. Now, while we're on that subject, I got an email from a British comrade named Troy as follows. Dear HAC, I live in Great Britain. What size of donation do you require to cover the costs for mailing an intro pack to me? Where do I make the payment? Signed, Troy. Okay, FYI, folks. Our full Northwest Front introductory packet is usually sent out to addresses within the United States by prepaid priority mail padded mailer. It contains 6 or 7 back issues of Northwest Observer, some miscellaneous leaflets and brochures, sometimes some touristy stuff from various places in the Northwest if I have any available, basically whatever I've got lying around at the time, a couple of CDs, including 1 or 2 Radio Free Northwests, and a CD copy of my Introduction to the Northwest Front, and finally, there will be a printed copy of the 5th edition of the White Book. That's a lot of literature. It's expensive, and even by prepaid priority mail envelope, it's $6.10 in postage. A large part of our budget, quite frankly, goes for introductory packets, which I will usually send out for free if someone wants one. If I get a request that is even semi-polite and from someone who appears to have at least a couple of brain cells to rub together. Sometimes people will send us $10 or so afterwards to compensate us for the cost of the literature and the postage, but more often I send out the intro pack and that's the last we hear from them, and yes, that's a big expense, I know. As a quick digression, it is vitally important, for reasons that I've gotten into on this show before, that the party maintain a line of political and racial literature in hard copy form that can be held in the hand and has some existence outside of a computer screen. We have to be something besides a computer game or an online fantasy world. There needs to be something real about us. Now, one of the reasons that we don't have local units around the Northwest so far is that any would-be unit leader is required by the White Book to step out from behind the computer at least a few short steps. He or she must obtain and maintain a physical mailing address involving a real human being dealing with actual hold-in-the-hand mail. And you know, back in pre-internet days when we were mostly nothing but post office boxes, I never thought I would see the time come when a post office box was considered to be a sign of real-world commitment, but strange times we live in, Master Jack. Northwest Front contacts are not and cannot be allowed to be nothing but faceless email addresses. For one thing, there are still people out there, serious people, who don't have access to personal computers. I know that's hard to believe, but yeah, it's true. Now, working for and with the party has to involve stepping out from behind the computer, at least in a small way, and back into the real world, even if it's just to the extent of handling real physical mail and letting others know a mail drop address where you will at least intermittently show up in the flesh to collect mail. You can even do it under a pseudonym. That's fine. Look, I understand that our people have jobs they have to protect, but the party has to exist somewhere outside the internet. Otherwise, the whole thing is nothing but a kind of online fantasy world, and white boys find those entirely too easy to retreat into. And by the way, that gets into something I'll be talking about later in this podcast. Anyway, getting back to the intro packs in the mail. Yes, I know that these big, huge intro packs are a hemorrhage of funds. Most of those people who casually say, "Hey, Hurl, send me some free stuff," most of these people are just looky-loos. We will never hear from them again, and I know this even as I stuff their envelope full of goodies. But it's a chance that we have to take. It's a necessary speculative investment in our future. Now, the white nationalist movement has always been mostly looky-loos, but I can't afford to take the chance that one young kid to whom one day we do not send an intro pack for whatever reason, either because we're too stingy and we demand money up front, or maybe because we're just too broke, or because I just forget in one of my senile fugue states. Anyway, I can't take the chance that the young white boy we miss that way might be the one who would have been inspired to make total life commitment to the Northwest Republic and turned out to be our Northwest Commander Rockwell. If only somebody could have been bothered to give him some time and attention, invest the $10 needed to send him an intro pack, and then follow through. Keep up with him and mentor him and answer his questions. Now, this last is the part that I myself seldom have time for anymore and which I cannot do on my own. The following up and the following through. That's where you guys are supposed to step up and step in. Now, that's another thing that we're going to have to talk about, and I'm wandering way, way, way off the topic of Troy's questions, so let me drag myself kicking and screaming back to the point. Overseas intro packs. They are murderously expensive for me to send out, depending on the weight and the distance they have to travel. I have sent packets and light books overseas that for various reasons cost over $20 in postage, and for me to actually physically send a signed hardback copy of Freedom Sons from here to almost anywhere in Europe costs, I can't remember exactly, but something like between $50 and $60. Now, in order to send anything outside the country, even to Canada, we must now fill out a customs declaration form the size of a blanket. The customs form data must then be entered into the post office computers manually by the clerk at the counter to make sure that they've got it all right, repeating all of what you just written out by hand on the form. Now, considering the low level of competency and literacy in American postal workers, that takes a lot of time. If I have 3 or 4 overseas packages, I can be at the counter for half an hour, 45 minutes, getting dirty looks from the rest of the people in the post office for holding up the line. By the way, for those of you who never experienced them, lines in an American post office are the closest thing that we have to the lines that people in the old Soviet Union used to have to stand in for bread and milk and whatnot. Same reason, you're dealing with a socialized government monopoly. I stood in enough post office lines for the Royal Mail back when I lived in the UK, so I know that you guys over there across the pond get that as well. Long story short, I know the party has a lot of fans in Europe and Australia and New Zealand. Now, if you want full intro packs and printed copies of the White Book, I'll send them to you. But I would consider it to be a friendly gesture, at least, if you were to send me about $20 American to defray expenses. Overseas airmail subscriptions to Northwest Observer are $50 per year, and we don't make any profit on those. Now, as to how to send us money, you can go to a bank or a cambio of the kind that I used to see on every street corner in London and simply buy an American $20 bill and drop it in the mail, preferably to the Port Orchard address. The United States mail, despite its bad reputation in some quarters, is, in fact, pretty darn reliable. And the only time I've ever had any trouble with stuff disappearing in the mail is in Texas for some reason. Or you can simply drop some of your local currency in the mail. Now, we have banks here that exchange Swedish kroners and pounds sterling and euros and Australian dollars and whatnot. I usually save up all my foreign shekels and exchange them in one big batch once a year, but that's fine. It's the thought that counts.
Work shall make you free. It should be obvious to anyone with half a brain as to who would put up a sign like that. It was obviously put up by those people that hate lazy-ass people, such as the working class. Now, let us not get our knickers in a twist. That sign was put up by the German working class, who hated lazy-ass Jews, gypsies, and the bourgeois. Karl Marx wrote an essay on the Jewish question. He wrote it because he knew that the German workers hated the Jews. To a proper National Socialist, the Holocaust was not a myth. It is that Jews deserve a Holocaust. Judaism is an evil religion that supports the idea that us Gentiles are cattle and that we deserve to be their slaves. Us Nordics are Vikings, which means we kings or we are all kings. We are not slaves and we will never be slaves. Let remind you of the song Rule Britannia. Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the waves, Britons never, never, never shall be slaves. The idea that all men were created equal needs to be changed to all Nordics were created equal. Evolution does not teach racial equality. It teaches us that some are more evolved than others. Now, communists have the slogan, workers of the world unite. This is, of course, not going to happen, because other races are content to be slaves. They are willing to cross any picket line put up by the Nordics, who are struggling for higher wages. Because other races are content to be slaves, they need to be called scabs. So instead of calling the Mexicans wetbacks or spics or the Jew kikes, we need to call the Mexicans scabs and the Jews bourgeois pigs. Now, Hitler wrote Mein Kampf with the express purpose of converting Marxists and other workers to become National Socialists, so that if a Marxist does not hate Jews, then he is a traitor to the working class. Also, if a so-called Marxist supports the invasion of wetbacks, then he is supporting the invasion of the scabs, and that makes him a traitor to the working class. And what is to be done with the traitors to the working class? Treason carries a death penalty. The Jewish press called National Socialism a right-wing movement because of its nationalism. However, nationalism is altruistic in that you are supporting the group known as the nation. Patriotism in a capitalist society means supporting the wealth and privilege of the few who are rich, whereas nationalism in a socialist country means supporting the whole nation and not just the few. The American left calls the Jewish press and media the corporate press. Well, do you still believe the corporate lies of the Jewish press and media? Do you still believe that the sign "Work shall make you free" was put up by right-wingers or the corporate ruling class? Hitler was an unemployed Vienna street artist. There is no such thing as a right-wing unemployed street artist. We have people over here, unfortunately, Harold might be one of them, who are complaining that National Socialism hasn't got anywhere, and it hasn't got anywhere for the last 60 years. Well, it hasn't got anywhere because it has been going in the wrong direction for the last 60 years. National Socialism is a left-wing political movement. We hate communism for the same reason that Protestants hate Catholicism. Communism is an apostasy. Jews are not socialists or communists. Jews are the bourgeois, the ruling class. A communist party being run by the ruling class has no business calling itself a communist or socialist party. It is a fraud. If you are stupid enough to belong to a Jewish-led communist party, then you will get Jewed. And the workers that you lead will also get Jewed. Got it? We had a chiropractor in Georgia saying that Jews are socialists, and he called his publication The Truth at Last. Huh? I'm sorry, but Jews are not socialists, neither are Freemasons. Freemasonry is the secret society of the British ruling class. If you belong to a communist or socialist party being run by Jews or Freemasons, then you are belonging to a fraud. Now, in the camps such as Auschwitz, the inmates were given either a single triangle, or in the case of the Jews, two triangles. The color of the triangle determined what aspect of Freemasonry you belonged to. It is believed that Freemasonry wrote the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which outlines a system of government which enslaves the population. Now let us take a look at Jehovah's Witnesses, who were given a lilac triangle to wear in the camps. Charles Taze Russell was the founder of the Watchtower Bible Tract Society that has become known as Jehovah's Witnesses. Now any German who was a Jehovah's Witness could renounce his religion and be released. So was Charles Taze Russell, a 33rd level Freemason, the highest level. Now it is said by Freemasons themselves in Morals and Dogma that Freemasons worship Lucifer or Satan. So was Charles Taze Russell a 33rd level Freemason? And was he establishing a religion for his lord and master, Lucifer? The answer is yes, he was a 33rd level Mason, the same as Rothschild. He is buried in Pennsylvania next to a 10-foot-high stone pyramid, which was put there by the Watchtower Society. Of course, that is not the only religion established by Freemasons. Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormons, was also a 33rd level Mason. Finally, how many Christians did Jimmy Carter appoint to his cabinet? The answer is none. Zero. Satan said to Jesus, "I will give you all the kingdoms of the world if you bow down to me." So did Jimmy Carter bow down to Satan? Was he a member of an upper-class secret society? Did he belong to CFR? Was he afraid of being murdered if he did not go along with CFR? Jimmy Carter had tears in his eyes when he told his friend, who had campaigned for him and compiled a list of Christians qualified to be in his cabinet, that who was to be in his cabinet had already been decided on by the upper-class secret society. So just like the other Judas, Carter needs to hang himself upside down in Potter's Field. He said to Peter, "You will deny knowing me 3 times. Well, Jimmy, the cock is crowing. The loony left is following Gandhi, believing that non-violent political action can somehow achieve their political objectives. However, Gandhiism only works in a democracy, whereby politicians are afraid of their public image. America has become a plutocracy, meaning a country ruled by gangsters. The classic example of gangsterism is the conduct of the FBI and the CIA and other alphabet agencies. America is ruled by corporations and big money. The classic example is the head of the Federal Health Department, which is headed by a former board member of Monsanto, which is responsible for genetically modified food, such as corn and soybean, which leads to the condition known as leaky gut. People who believe that Obama is on the left, supporting the working class or the downtrodden, are not paying attention as to who has been appointed to his cabinet. Now let us take a look at what the American Indians have been able to achieve with their political action during the 60s and 70s. At first, they followed Gandhiism, in that their demonstrations for Indian rights were nonviolent. All this nonviolent political action led to nothing. Up to 60 Indians had been murdered on the Pine Ridge Reservation, which is next to Wounded Knee, but they retaliated and murdered two FBI agents. After that, the feds passed the famous Bolt decision, giving the Indians their fishing rights. Now, when you are dealing with a gangster form of government, there is only one thing that gangsters will respect, and that is the vendetta. In a plutocracy, the will of the public is ignored. The only thing that is listened to is either money or a vendetta. National Socialism believes that its political objectives can be achieved by the same philosophy as Maoism. Political power grows out of the barrel of a firearm. Now, the working class are called the 99% by the Occupy movement, so that once we have the support of the white working class, we'll be able to establish a white separate state without a shot being fired. Why? The answer is deterrence. The Jewish ruling class will be outgunned. Hitler was able to gain the support of the German military. We can and must do the same. Even our military do not want a country ruled by a bunch of gangsters. If you doubt that America is ruled by gangsters, then go to veteranstoday.com. If you read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, you will see that they have the support of what is known in Europe as the underworld. The term underworld means organized crime. Now, the mainstream press, or media, is in the hands of the Jews. The left calls it the corporate press. But if they did their homework, the corporate press is Jewish. To establish a righteous government, it requires a war against gangsters, who in America work for the alphabet agencies.
Okay, now, last week I promised you an audio file from a German comrade, which I had not listened to at that time. I have listened to it since then, and this is either an American or an Irishman trying to sound like an American, but that's fine. I understand that if he were to be tracked down by the German secret police, he'd go to prison for about 10 years, even for something as mild as this. I'd kind of like to have a real German on here one day, but given the incredible risks involved, I can see why there aren't too many Freiwilligers stepping forward. This comrade goes by the name of Johann Scharf.
Greetings from southern Germany, comrades. You're listening to Radio Free Northwest, and my name is Johannes Scharf. A couple of years ago, when I was a sailor and did not yet know about the Northwest Imperative and Harold Covington's novels, I myself wrote a novel with a quite similar topic. I will now read to you the blurb of the German book, which I translated into English. I am still looking for someone who is willing to translate the whole book, for I myself don't quite have the time nor the ability. The title is Southern Cross, Exodus from Europe, a futuristic novel. Europe in the year 2033. On the European continent, but also in the United States, chaos rules. After a short but fierce clash of cultures, most formerly European states are run now by the lower class, and the collards gain power. France was turned into an Islamic theocracy in the aftermath of bloody riots and revolts in France in 2031. How horrifically realistic such scenarios in the future might be can be discovered from statistics which state that Islam will already be the strongest religious power in France by 2020 if there is not a dramatic change in the demographic trend of today. On the basis of thrillingly narrated individual stories, the reader receives an overview of the hopeless domestic and foreign political situation of countries like Germany, Great Britain, the United States, and many other once European countries whose continents on the beginning of the 2030s has changed beyond recognition. However, at the same time, a right-wing political party in New Zealand, which has yet remained mostly European-influenced, gains power and forms the new government. They soon invite all the whites who are willing to work and live in New Zealand and give them the great opportunity of a new beginning. Like a phoenix from the ashes, the new state shall rise, built and founded on the will to survive and the diligence and idealism of the New Zealanders and the white settlers who have awoken from their slumber and followed the great call from Vancouver to Vladivostok. A ship owner from Germany dares to convert his freighter into a passenger ship to take Europeans aboard who are bound to New Zealand. Another adventure begins right off the coast of Louisiana. A ramshackle old fishing boat with only minimum crew is on its way to the shore of New Zealand. Will they make it? That was the blurb. I think that it is imperative for the white Americans to come together in a specific area where they will be able to survive. It is not about religious beliefs or different lifestyles, it is about survival of a race, and about survival only. To be or not to be is the question, like in Shakespeare's Hamlet. We have to indeed start creating homelands better today than tomorrow. You hear it on the radio show every week, folks. Get into your trucks and start driving. For many Europeans still living in their home countries in continental Europe, the Pacific Northwest might be their homeland of choice. Yet, I believe that we should have multiple homelands all over the globe for the 7% of our kinsmen. Hail victory from Germany, comrades.
This is Sean Davey from the Pilgrim's Suite.
but this it can be done. Oh, we've got a long way to go, and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. If you put hard on the pedal, some never mind the brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got to run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you with another installment from my road. Yeah, the day before Labor Day, I was on a load going from Southern California up to Fargo, North Dakota, and was skirting along the edge of the homeland. And for you outdoorsy types that are into the outdoor sports, recreation type thing, up there in the Island Lake area on US 20 there in Idaho, they have a lot of snowmobiling and stuff in that area. As I turned to head north into Montana and stuff, for you sportsmen, the anglers were out in force along the rivers there, fishing for whatever they were after. I'm really not into fishing, but I thought I'd go and bring you that little update that there's a lot of rivers up here and a lot of fishing. The ones I saw were doing it from boats, using waders also, and bank fishing along the sides of the river and stuff, casting out into the water after their catches. And there's a lot of deer, elk, moose, or as a one Navy chief used to like to call it, Clydesdales with horns. Up here in this neck of the woods, there in the Rockies, Montana, and Idaho area around Yellowstone, where we skirt the edge of quite a bit, hauling loads back and forth. Trust me, if I can hit them with my semi, I'm sure you guys can drop them with your rifles or your bow and arrow. I've seen whole herds of elk come across in front of me, running from one field across the highway to the other on Montana 200 on numerous occasions. There, it's west of I-15 in the Lincoln area up there in Montana, just east of Lincoln around Rogers Pass. Also seen quite a few hunters along I-90 there up by Lookout Pass, hiking alongside the road, looking for their game and stuff, coming in and out of the woods up there in that neck of the woods. So, you may have game in your area, but we've got it abundantly up here also. So, pack up your moving vans and trucks and whatever you're going to be using and head on up this way because, like I say, there's game to be had. A buddy of mine who is a firefighter in Bremerton, he used to go up to Forks every year and he used to get himself a deer and sometimes an elk every year. Have a safe one.
Okay. This is a trucker coming at you from State Line, Wisconsin, on my way to upstate New York. And as our comrade from the other side of the pond put it, this last week's episode, how much easier can it be for you to migrate to the Northwest, to the homeland where you should be? Even from Florida, it's about a 5-day drive. If you're going and taking it easy, and you can bus butt and get it done a lot faster than that if you really put your mind to it. Back in my younger days, when I was in the Navy, I was on a motorcycle and made it from northern Michigan, woke up with the birds in the morning on Tuesday, and Wednesday evening, I laid my head down on my own pillow in Washington State. 2 days across most of the country to Puget Sound area. So don't tell me it can't be done. Yes, I know you probably get tired of hearing me say it, but oh, I'm waiting to see all the U-Hauls and Penske trucks and whatnot, out-of-state plates, headed to the Northwest. I mean, it's, like I said, fairly easy to get across country. All you've got to do is put your mind to it. Pack up your assets, put them in the truck, or if you don't want to drive a truck, get a pods unit. They'll deliver it to your house, load up all your stuff into it. They'll come pick it up, they'll store it for you, and deliver it at your residence in the homeland. It can't get much easier than that if you don't want to go and spend the cost of the moving truck and the movers and all that. If you want to do it yourself, that's another way to do it. It's real easy. I've done Navy moves before, self moves, and long distance moves where the movers came in and packed it up and moved. But I haven't had to do that a whole lot. My last move into my current residence, it was a self move, and it was done with a bunch of pickup trucks and a few strong backs, and that took care of the problem. That you can probably go and pull the same thing off buy a case or two of beer and a couple boxes of pizza and invite all your old friends over to help you pack up and move and get it into the van, and then there would be comrades up here at the other end. If I'm in town, I could even help out. Granted, I'm out on the road a whole lot, but that's an option for you. It's real nice weather right now, and here shortly the snow is going to start flying. It's already flown at least once over there in Montana. The Labor Day weekend, I saw snow on the hilltops there on my way through. I'm going to North Dakota, so winter is starting to set in up here in the northern tier. I guess Wyoming already had I-80 closed at least once due to snow and stuff, so.
Yep, it's coming down your last few days before, or month or whatever, before the snow starts flying. And you'll probably have to wait till next year unless you really feel like trudging across in the wintertime, which is not recommended, especially if you're not used to driving in snow and ice and all that, because you'll definitely be hitting that between wherever you are in the homeland in the wintertime. Pretty much guaranteed, unless you catch a really good weather window. Well, this is it for this edition from the Trucker. Travel safe, comrades, and hope to see you in the homeland soon.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Before I really get going on today's Real Politics material, I need to answer a question I was sent over Facebook. Comrade John, I am really sorry it took me so long to even see it. For the record, if one of you wants to talk to me, make sure your message is going to a place I'll actually see. I tend to ignore the Other tab when I'm looking at Facebook messages, and John's question was buried there for a couple of months. Anyway, Comrade John asked, if the state of Nazi Germany had not been defeated in war, do you think it would have held together over time? Would the socialist elements have eventually agitated against the nationalist side, as in Röhm and his essay? Do you think it would have allowed for stable transition of power from one leader to another? Are you aware that the Ba'ath Party of Iraq and Syria was modeled on the NSDAP? In those situations, the dear leader eventually outshined the party. Do you think the fact that there was no check or balance on the leader's power was a good thing or bad thing? It is a known fact that several military mistakes are directly attributed to Hitler. I'm interested in National Socialism, but am not quite ready to admit it is the greatest form of government ever. Ethnic nation-states ruled by hereditary monarchies did the lion's share of putting the white man on top back in the day. I'm actually in a unique position to answer this question. I myself am not a National Socialist, though some would say otherwise. During a routine party meeting, Mac once described me as an agnostic National Socialist, so do what you will with my response. Further, it's not at all the case that the Northwest Front pushes National Socialism or requires it of those interested in Northwest Nationalism. No one here advocates it as essential racial dogma. I don't perceive National Socialism to be racially unhealthy, and if the NAR ends up being a National Socialist state, that would be just fine with me. There are two separate parts to John's question, the second of which I'll take first. John, you made a number of very important observations about history and the leaders in it. Regardless of the government involved, mistakes are attributed to any and every leader. My first Real Politics talk actually went over the reality that America was almost a monarchy instead of the wrong-headed experiment the founding felons crafted. After that, I went on to point out, in practice, non-democratic forms of government tend to look the same since there's either one person or a very small group exercising a very large amount of power. This is true for any non-democratic system, be it National Socialism, hereditary monarchy, or some variety of oligarchy. In any of these systems, the people in charge will always be the main focus since they're the ones responsible for what ends up happening, not their parties, supporters, or peers. In reality, checks and balances will always exist in some way. Factions exist, and always will, even in admittedly desirable monarchical systems. Exchanges of power weren't always pleasant, so that concern is ever present in any type of government. Out of respect for John's concerns, I'm trying to stay objective. Even so, I have to point out that Adolf Hitler is criticized from all angles, especially in the movement. To be honest, this is all hindsight analysis, and in retrospect, everyone screws up. Always investigate and consider the past, but don't stress over these sorts of things since they'll always be. As for the first part of the question, I really don't see why National Socialism wouldn't have stuck around for a while. Sure, white people tend to organically create shiny new ideas and philosophies, so I'm sure it would have eventually been replaced by something else. But that's not exactly germane. It's true that varying factions exist in every environment, but socialists wouldn't have had much of a reason to agitate in Nazi Germany. There's no way every single person was happy, but that's just people for you. Nationalism and socialism aren't mutually exclusive. Remember, socialism isn't the same thing as communism, much to Rush Limbaugh's chagrin. Just look at the difference between the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich. National Socialism would have lasted since it was good for just about every last German. But why? Well, aside from the obvious racial angle, we need to consider economics. With an honest economic system, Germany was able to rise out of the disastrous state it was in and actually enable common people to enjoy what would have been high luxury in other European countries. You might say the National Socialist policies had a high ROI, or return on investment. Today's talk is about just that. In mid-December of last year, I did a housekeeping segment on RFN which has bearing on this subject. The party and I are regularly approached about a possible, though somewhat fanciful, Northwest agency which would theoretically give substantial physical and financial assistance to those trying to come home. The trouble with this idea is that the party would only agree to expend resources on those we think to be a good investment. More specifically, the outlay of money in particular would cause the party to expect a good return on that outlay in the form of skills and services rendered by the migrants we would help with said money. That is, we would expect a good ROI. This is totally reasonable, since otherwise we wasted precious resources. Just breaking even means we wasted the opportunity to use those resources in a better way. I can hear you all wondering what in the world this might have to do with real politics. Remember back to the RFN episode where I discussed the actual solution. That, or think back to the Northwest Independence novels. For this purpose, I like A Distant Thunder because it covers some of the fictional party activity prior to the revolution itself. There's a particular strategy required to liberate colonial territory from a large occupying power. Everything the party does needs to align itself with that objective. But hang on now, don't any of you slack in listening, since this part is important. Prior to actually making a bid for independence, there are things which need to happen in order to support that bid. By the by, they're still technically legal, but that's neither here nor there. Anyhow, the return on investment of our legal activity must be the ability to execute and support the strategy which we've adopted. Now, short of you people actually coming home and helping the party, we can't actually do what we need to. However, it's still the case that we can waste our time and resources doing things we shouldn't do, and that's just as bad, because it actually results in a negative ROI. Now here's the thing. It would be dumb of the party to invest the manpower, time, and money required to relocate someone of T-shirt youth quality, because doing so is guaranteed to result in the total loss of that investment. That's a bad ROI. There's nothing but cost and risk, with no potential for a payoff of any sort. It wouldn't result in anything but a drain on the party, so it's not something we're going to do. Not only does it not further the work required to create a fighting white revolutionary party in the Pacific Northwest, it actually detracts from other things we need to accomplish in the interim. Now, with this base, I can make my point. There's another activity which white nationalists are prone to, even though it has an abysmal ROI. Harold has taken to calling this phenomenon streetwalking. And no, this isn't about prostitution. Public demonstrations are a white nationalist movement perennial favorite, but they're absolutely the wrong thing to do. Let's recap. There's only one solution to white genocide, and that's the Northwest American Republic. There's only one way to realize that solution. See the Northwest Independence novels for details. Since that's the case, anything which either doesn't contribute to or detracts from it doesn't give us any return and is, therefore, the wrong thing to do. I'm going to wrap up today's talk analyzing the ROI of streetwalking. This has come up several times on RFN, but I want to try this approach to see if it's any more effective. Hey, I can dream, can't I? All right, so here's the deal with streetwalking. A few of us get the bug to run around and make idiots out of ourselves with a sign and possibly chanting something pithy because we feel the need to be brave and show the world what mighty white Power Rangers we are. Of course, there's the immediately obvious cost and risk involved. Aside from the financial cost of whatever physical equipment, signs, funny costumes, and transportation is required, there's the immediate issue of one's identity being exposed to the world. There's also the less tangible risk of making white nationalists look bad, but I'll get there in a second. The one viable strategy we have available to us needs functional, reasoning adults who aren't all gummed up in society because their politics are known to the world at large. Exposing oneself not only puts you at risk, it puts your comrades around you at risk of exposure as well. Whatever you take away from my talk today, you do not, under any circumstances, have the right to make that choice for other people. Doing so comes desperately close to deliberately outing them yourself, and the party will take notice of it when it happens. Think on that for a bit. But enough about risk. What about the rewards? Well, there aren't any. Streetwalking and other public events do not assist the strategy required to create the Northwest American Republic. Mass demonstrations and political action aren't a part of the Butler Plan, so at best they're a wash. And remember, a wash is as good as a loss because it's missed opportunity to do something else. Let's figure the ROI on this. All risk and loss with no reward. Wait a minute. That's a terrible return. No, really. At best, the only thing to come of this is an emotional and possibly hormonal high, which is the real reason anyone ever does this. I get that many of you out there are really into this sort of thing, but it's just not helpful or relevant to what really needs to happen. And since I'm on the subject, don't try to sell me on the idea that this is brave. Bravery doesn't mean taking stupid risks for no payoff, so public activity doesn't entail any sort of bravery. It's stupidity, a little drunkenness, well, most of the time anyway, and perhaps a little roid rage if we're to believe stereotypes of white nationalists. Even if there were zero risk involved in streetwalking, it would still be useless because it doesn't play a role in the task we need to accomplish. Conversely, it's not cowardly to refuse to engage in dangerous activity when there's nothing to gain by it. I've said before that I used to do my fair share of public activity, but it wasn't related to racial politics. Further, when I did so, it was to stop specific events which were happening at specific times and places, and I was one of what was usually a very, very large number of people. I figured I'd better come clean since someone would call me on it if I didn't. Don't compare what I did with what goes on in white nationalism. The two are worlds apart. I would go into details, but it would be rude of me to go on longer. I know some of you are absolutely obsessed with public demonstrations, but please think back on what I said about obsession and enthusiasm. Actually think about what you're doing in the future. Your bad behavior will eventually cost you, and possibly someone else, very dearly, while buying your race absolutely nothing. Why throw your potential away like this when you could properly participate in the Northwest Imperative? Hail victory, comrades.
As you may have heard, the voters in Scotland turned down the independence referendum. I'm not going to get into that situation because it's very complex, and frankly, Americans, I think, would have a difficult time wrapping their minds around the actual facts of the matter, which, among other things, are that the so-called Scottish nationalists are a bunch of raving, screaming leftist reds and so forth and so on, but we're not going to get into that. However, I will play a very old Sour Grapes Scottish song from 1707, when the original Act of Union was passed, using pretty much the same tactics that the British used to beat it this time. This is Steely Span.
to all our Scottish fame. Farewell, our ancient glory. Farewell, even to our Scottish name, so famed in martial story.
Okay, the show is running way long this week with all the outside submissions, and even as things are, it looks like we'll have to give Gretchen a miss this week. Catch you next week, honey. Now, from now on, I'm going to be getting a little bit more serious and internal on these podcasts because, as I've said, the fact is that this is the best communications medium the party has right now. And also because I view all of you who are listening to RFN in these early stages of the movement as potential leaders in the coming struggle for Northwest freedom. And you're going to have to start making these decisions yourselves one day. Now, earlier this year, I mentioned in previous episodes of Radio Free Northwest that for some time, there's been a kind of running debate or discussion between people in our group's inner circle, insofar as we have one, as to how the Northwest Front should be organized, i.e. either the Rotary Club template or the Secret Squirrel Plan. Now, for reasons which I went into at that time having to do with the nature of the increasingly oppressive surveillance state we live in, and also with the problematic character of white Americans, Secret Squirrel has so far more or less won out. The fifth edition of the White Book, when it comes to actual party organization, is about three-quarters Secret Squirrel and a quarter Rotary Club. Now, certain things are laid down for all time, such as no membership cards, ever. Because in light of the John Hinckley episode, we can't risk carrying the weight for whatever some weirded-out white boy who hears voices in his head might do and then get captured or killed with a party membership card in his wallet. Now, that's the character problem, one of many aspects of it. That having been said, when I went into all that earlier this year, I mentioned that one of the advantages of the Rotary Club format, i.e. formal organization with official membership and cards and chief cooks and bottle washers, was the ability to formally demand dues from actual members rather than just ask you folks as listeners and good buddies to be nice guys and drop us $10 a month voluntarily. Now, I've explained the 10-by-1,000 plan on several previous occasions wherein I demonstrated that 1,000 white people kicking in $10 a month and an extra $100 twice a year for fund appeals would raise $320,000 a year, and that's the mortgage or rent on a headquarters. That's a monthly tabloid newspaper with a big enough print run for street distribution. That's a fully equipped internet radio studio. And that's enough for minimum salaries for a small staff of highly skilled and dedicated full-time people, all of which would in turn generate yet more money and yet more members every year. There, I just explained it again. Like everything else I say, it just doesn't seem to be registering. Between 4,000 and 5,000 people will listen to this podcast this week. Will we get 1,000 of you to send us $10 a month? No. Because you regard this show as a form of entertainment, not as something to be taken seriously to the extent of giving up a 6-pack or even a 12-pack of the cheap brew. Never mind something to which duty demands you devote your entire life. Now, when that changes, that's when we start winning. Now, to be sure, enough of you do voluntarily contribute to keep me fed and clothed and not living under a bridge with my computer and my other possessions all in a shopping cart. And for that, I am extremely grateful. It is you people who do that who make possible what little I'm able to accomplish. I've always taken the view that there's nothing wrong with quote-unquote living off the movement if you're actually doing something that is essential or at least worthwhile for the 14 words. Although there is something wrong with someone living well off the movement, which I most certainly do not, as those of you who have visited me in what passes for my home can attest. But it's true, like Blanche DuBois, I am dependent on the kindness of strangers. I'm not joking about the seriousness of that aspect of my life. I'm a 61-year-old white male in poor health with a traceable political past, which means I couldn't even get hired as a Walmart greeter. I know, I've tried. I'm not eligible for Social Security for another year, and that wouldn't be enough to live on anyway, and because of my race and gender, I'm not even eligible for food stamps. Long story. Cutting to the chase, there is a small group of people among you who are quite literally keeping me alive. Thank you. Now, from this fact arises the occasional snide comments that you hear on the internet from goat dancers of various stripes about how I quote-unquote live off the movement and live off donations. Look, I am not going to go off into a long tirade justifying myself. These people are idiots. Their opinion on anything is worthless. This is a matter of common sense, and you either get it or you don't. But there is one aspect of my position here that needs to be emphasized. One of the advantages of my quote-unquote living off the movement as I do is that I am more or less financially bulletproof. If nothing else, pure moral decency demands that someone devote themselves to this cause full-time, and I can function for the party as a full-time worker, doing everything from mailing out the intro packs and maintaining inventories of our books and answering emails to doing this show every week. And above all, I can act as a public spokesman for the party should we ever somehow break through the blackout enough for that need to arise. It's already happened a few times. I've given a few interviews, the most recent being to that TV station in Fort Carson, Colorado, about that incident they had with the leaflets. Still not breaking through the blackout, really, but the need does arise on occasion. Now, it's been a long time since I've done anything like the Phil Donahue or Tom Snyder shows, but I think I could still handle myself if I were suddenly in the spotlight. And I would be able to, because there's no way they can retaliate against me. They say that a man who has a family gives hostages to fortune. Well, I have no hostages to fortune. Although, let's face it, I'm not anywhere near as photogenic as, say, David Duke still is. And that's even more important than ever, since print media is almost dead now. But the fact is that I am here. I'm available, I'm capable, and I have experienced a media feeding frenzy before, which is now a rare bit of experience among our so-called white nationalist leaders who mostly exist on the internet. Now, most of us from the old days are gone now. These characters today who run the quasi-intellectual blogs would probably scream in horror and crap in their Fruit of the Looms if the CNN and Fox News camera crew showed up at their mother's house and rooted them out of her basement, kind of like pale gophers. I, on the other hand, have no job or family that I have to protect. When the news crews roll up and the Klieg lights go on and cameras start getting shoved in people's faces, I won't flee into my house and hide and scream for lawyers to protect me like poor old Steve Kendall did back in 96, because he had a wife and a child and a good job, and it all came crashing down in a single moment when he stepped outside to go to work one Patrick's Day morning and he found the camera crews waiting for him. Federal law enforcement refers to people like me as having a short tail. I have no family, I have no hostages to fortune, and I have no job that can be used as leverage against me. Because of your help, I'm ready if and when the need arises. And experience shows that the need can arise very quickly and unexpectedly. Somebody associated with the Northwest Front could do something wild at heart and weird on top tomorrow morning. I hope not, or if he does, I hope nobody gets killed, but it can happen. Trust me on this. It has happened in the past. Now, all this leads into what I really want to talk to you guys about. The kind of party that the Northwest Front is going to have to become, be it through Rotary Club or Secret Squirrel. And we're going to have to professionalize, by which I mean we are going to have to create cadres of full-time people. The Northwest Volunteers, who are described in the fifth edition of the White Book. The Northwest Volunteers will be kind of equivalent to a made man in the mob. Most likely, the first volunteers will be young, single men who intuitively understand that America offers them no future worth living. Or else, early middle-aged divorced men who have had their lives ruined by America, who have finally learned wisdom and who understand that they have nothing left to lose. That's natural. Any revolutionary movement is going to attract the people who have been screwed by the existing system, and basically young white males and middle-aged white males are the people who are on the receiving end of most of America's crap. I do hope and believe that we will attract more and more women as time goes on, as more and more women come to understand that they too are victims. That white men are not their enemies, not their competitors, and that we are their brothers, and we share the same persecution and the same horrible experience of this rotten society. Now, these Northwest Volunteers will work full-time for the party, like me, and that means that they're going to have to be paid at least some pittance or other in order to keep body and soul together and keep those volunteers personally and politically functional. Now, the best analogy I can offer is that the Northwest Volunteers will be kind of like a monastic order. There will be no formal vows of poverty or celibacy, but realistically speaking, that's what life is going to be like for most of them. A total 24-hour devotion to racial duty because Democrat America allows nothing else for white boys who refuse to conform. Now, we're going to have to create this professional party, and that means that in the future, I'm going to have to get a lot more chatty and forthright on the issue of money. I've probably been too diffident and bashful about money in the past. For example, I haven't put out a formal and official fund appeal as such in almost 2 years. Now, that's going to have to change, and that means that we're going to be getting more and more goat dancing on the internet, which we will simply have to ignore. Nothing is served by white nationalists avoiding or evading or sugarcoating or simply concealing the truth about our own situation from ourselves. It is time for us to face up to the truth headlong about where we are and what has to be done. Or actually, it's not time, because I'm running way, way long and our time is up. And so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha Andaban. Freedom. Oh, wait. I had only two music breaks on this one, didn't I? Tell you what, I'll close with that third number. Now, after my last little homily, I was going to close out with Money Makes the World Go Round from Cabaret, but that's a bit too sleazy for this show. Tell you what. Here's another song from Cabaret, this one by Saga.
The sun on the meadow is summery warm, and the stag in the forest runs free. Together to greet the storm, tomorrow belongs to me. Tomorrow belongs to me. The branch on the linden is leafy and green, and the Rhine gives its gold to the sea. But somewhere a glory awaits unseen. Tomorrow belongs to me. Tomorrow belongs to me. His cradle is closing his eyes, and the blossom embraces the bee. But soon sets the whisper, arise, arise, tomorrow belongs to me. And tomorrow belongs to me. Fatherland, show us the sign. Your children have been waiting to see. The morning will come when the world is mine. Tomorrow belongs to me. And tomorrow belongs to you.